This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Next week at the Grammys, country music singer Merle Haggard will be one of the recipients of a Lifetime Achievement Award. On today's Fresh Air, we hear from Haggard, as well as two other recipients, Eric Clapton for the band Cream and David Bowie. Music critic Peter Guralnick has said about Merle Haggard, quote, "There is no one in contemporary popular music who has created a more impressive legacy or one that spans a wider variety of styles," unquote. Haggard's best-known songs include Mama Tried, The Bottle Let Me Down, Okie from Muskogee, and Today I Started Loving You Again. He was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 1994. Last year, Haggard was on tour with Bob Dylan. 10 of Haggard's early albums from the 1960s and 70s have been remastered and will be reissued this month. As a young man, Merle Haggard was in and out of prison and hardly seemed destined for success. Those prison experiences are reflected in many of his songs. Before we hear a 1995 interview Terry Gross recorded with him, let's hear Haggard sing one of his best-known compositions, Mama Tried.
First thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, and no one could change my mind but Mama tried. The one and only rebel child from a family meek and mild, my mama seemed to know what lay in store. Out of all my Sunday learning, towards the bad I kept on turning, till Mama couldn't hold me anymore. And I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. Mama tried, Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried.
Merle Haggard, is this song autobiographical?
Well, it really is very, very close. At least there's some things we fudged on slightly to make it rhyme, but the majority of it, I'd say 97% of it's pretty accurate, I guess.
Your father died when you were 9, is that right?
9.
So
right.
Your mother had to raise you alone after that.
Yeah, and I was, to say the least, probably the most incorrigible child you could think of. I was already on the way to prison before I realized it, actually. I was really kind of a screw-up, and I really don't know why. I think it was mostly just out of boredom and lack of a father's attention, I think.
I think you were 14 when your mother put you in a juvenile home.
No, she didn't put me in a juvenile home. The authorities put me in there for truancy, for not going to school, and they gave me 6 months in like a road camp situation, and I ran off from there and stole a car, and. So then the next time I went back, it was for something serious. And then I spent the next 7 years running off from places. I think I escaped 17 times.
How would you escape from reform school and youth institutions?
Well, there was different institutions and different methods. There was some of them were minimum security, some were maximum security, and some of them were kid joints, and some of them were adult jailhouses. And I just didn't stay nowhere. I was just, I think Willie Sutton was my idol, if you don't know. You know, at the time, I was in the middle of becoming an outlaw and escaping from jail and escaping from places that they had me locked up in was part of the thing that I wanted to do.
So what was your most ingenious escape?
Probably the one that was the most ingenious was one that I didn't actually go on. I was San Quentin. I was all set to go with the only completely successful escape out of San Quentin, I think, in 21 years. But the people that gave me the chance to go were the same people that talked me out of it, because they felt like that I was just doing it for the sport of it, and then it was a very serious thing to the other fellow that was going, and they had a big judge's chamber sort of desk that they were building at the furniture factory in San Quentin, and I had a friend who was building a place for two guys to be transported out. That was before they had x-rays and things of that nature, and I could have gone, and I didn't go, and the guy that I went with wound up being executed in the gas chamber. He went out and held court in the street, killed a highway patrolman, and so it was really good that I didn't go.
Was that a real sobering experience for you?
Yeah, I've had a lot of those things in my life, and you know, those are the sort of things that that a guy unknowingly, like myself, I guess I was gathering up meat for songs, you know. I don't know what I was doing. I really kind of was crazy as a kid, and then all of a sudden, you know, and while I was in San Quentin, I just, I one day understood that I saw the light, and I just didn't want to do that no more, and I realized what a mess I'd made out of my life, and I got out of there and stayed out of there. Never did go back, and went and apologized to all the people I'd wronged, and tried to pay back the people that I'd taken money from, borrowed money from, or whatever. And I think when I was 31 years old, I paid everybody back that I'd ever taken anything from, and including my mother.
What'd you say to your mother when you changed your life around?
Well, it was just obvious. No, you know, there was no. I don't think there was ever any time that anybody in my family was worried about me staying with this. It was just the way that, you know, some people grow up in the Army, and you know, it's hard to be 18 years old, and you know, they send 18-year-old boys to war because they don't know what to do with them. And I was one that I wound up going to prison rather than war. And instead of growing up in the middle of a battlefield with bullets flying around me, I grew up on the isolation ward, death row. And that's where the song Mama Tried gets close to being autobiographical.
You were on death row?
Yeah, I was. I got caught for making beer. Making some beer up there, and I got too much of my own beer and got drunk in the yard and got arrested. And it's hard to get arrested in San Quentin, but I did. And they sent me to what was known as the Shelf, and the Shelf is a part of the North Block, which you share with the inmates on death row. And it's kind of like the there's not too many more stops for you, actually, you know. And that was the, as you put it, sobering experience for me. I wound up with nothing to lay on except a Bible and an old concrete slab, and woke up from that drunk that I'd been on that day, and I could hear some prisoners talking in the area next to me. In other words, there was a alleyway between the back of the cells, and I could hear people talking over there, and I recognized the guy as being Carol Chessman, a guy that they were fixing to execute. And I don't know, it was just something about the whole situation that I knew that if I ever got out of there, if I was lucky enough to get out, I made up my mind, well, I still had that hangover, that I was all finished.
How were you lucky enough to get out?
Well, I went back down on the yard and went down and asked for the roughest job in the penitentiary, which was a textile mill, and went down and just started building my reputation, you know, just started running in reverse from what I'd been doing and started trying to build up a long line of good things to be proud of, and that's what I've been doing since then.
Back in the days when you were in prison, was music a big part of your life then? Were you singing, playing, writing songs?
Yeah. Yeah, I was already into doing that. I really didn't, believe that I sincerely had a future in it. I think I was just kind of like doing what I thought was probably a waste of time or a hobby at the very most, and maybe some extra money on the weekend sort of thing. But that's when I was in San Quentin. I still didn't really thoroughly realize that I had to do this the rest of my life and that it was going to be this successful for me and I was going to, you know, have all the things happen that have happened. I had no idea that you could never have convinced me of a minute amount of the success I've had. I would never have believed it.
Did your musical ability have anything to do with people noticing you in prison and thinking that you could make it when you got out? I mean, did that help you at all in the warden's
eyes? Yeah, that was the basic reason, I think, that these friends of mine talked me out of going on that escape. I mean, they felt that I had talent, and they felt that I was just a ornery kid and could probably make something out of my life. And you know, believe it or not, in the penitentiary, just some pretty nice people and very unfortunate people. And they love to let somebody, so to speak, get up on their shoulders. You know, they like to boost somebody over the wall if they can. If they can't make it themselves, they, I think, sincerely love to see someone else make it.
Country music singer Merle Haggard speaking with Terry Gross in 1995. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1995 interview with Merle Haggard. Next week, he'll receive a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Grammy ceremonies.
Tell us a story how you got your first guitar.
My first guitar?
Yeah. Or how you started to play guitar.
Well,
as it was.
I have an older brother named Lowell, and Lowell had a service station at the time, and there was a guy who came in and wanted a couple of dollars worth of gas and didn't have no money, and he left a little Bronson, sort of a Stella Sears and Roebuck type guitar, as collateral, and he never did come back after it, and that old guitar sat in the closet there for a couple of years, and finally, I think my mother showed me a couple of chords. My brother didn't know how to play, and my dad had passed away. He was a musician in the family, so Mama showed me C chord that Daddy showed her, and she didn't know how to make C chord very good. But I took it from that, and I beat around on that old Bronson. I think it was a Bronson guitar.
I imagine when you first got the guitar, you were playing the songs that you heard on the radio. How did you start writing songs yourself?
Well, about the same time that I discovered Jimmy Rogers, I was about 12 years old, I discovered Hank Williams, and I remember seeing on the yellow MGM records there was the artist's name, and then there was another name underneath that artist. It was a small, very small letters, and it said composer, and I didn't know what a composer was. I asked my mother, I said, what does this mean? She said, I don't know, and she called the record store, and they told her, that's the writer, that's the guy that writes the songs. And it seemed to me that it was very important to have your name in both places there. I noticed that Hank Williams had a little extra clout because he wrote his own songs. Jimmy Rogers, the same thing, you know. And so I felt it was just as necessary to become a songwriter as it was to try to learn to play the guitar. It was certainly a tool that most people, I think, in the business would like to be a singer-songwriter if they could be, because it is in some way your retirement. You know, you can have a great career, and if you don't write songs or have a publishing company or something to lean back on when it's all over, it's a pretty hard drop back to reality, you know. And once you've learned to live under the conditions I've learned to live on, you better have yourself a publishing company or I'll have to go back to being an outlaw.
When you started writing songs, did you realize that you could write autobiographical songs from your own life, or did you think you had to copy other people's songs?
Well, I really didn't realize what method to take at first. I must have wrote maybe 1,500 songs that weren't any good, or at least I never kept them, and finally with a lot of help and a lot of people who had written hit songs, who I'd become friends with, such as Fuzzy Owen, who became my personal manager. It was a songwriter, and he helped me. He taught me how to write songs, and finally I wrote one that was worth keeping, and I think I've written about 300 keepers or so, maybe 400.
Do you remember the first one that you felt this is worth keeping?
Yeah, it was a sort of a rock and roll song, or a Elvis-type rock and roll thing. It was called If You Want to Be My Woman. And Glenn Campbell opened his shows with it for years, and I still do the song. And I wrote it when I was about 14.
Could you sing a couple of bars of it?
You like riding in the country in my Cadillac, and you keep... I keep pushing me back. Something about didn't own the money that I earned, but you refused to give me something equal in return. Don't look at me like maybe you don't understand. If you want to be my woman, you know you got to let me be your man.
Now, during all the years that you were in and out of prisons and reform schools, did you ever think I can make a living with music?
No, I counted on extra money, as I was saying. You know, like maybe a hobby. I figured I was going to have some other means of employment, or support.
So, what made you think, well, I can make a living out of this?
When I came out of the penitentiary, I went to work for my brother digging ditches and wiring houses. He had an electrical company, Hag Electric. And he was paying me $80 a week. This was 1960. And I was working 8 hours a day there. And I got me a little gig playing guitar 4 nights a week for $10 a night. There was a little radio show that we had to broadcast from this little nightclub called High Pockets. And it just all started from that. Some people that had, that was local stars around, heard me on this radio program and came down and offered me a better job in town. It wasn't just a matter of weeks till I was part of the main clique in Bakersfield, and it was hard to get in that clique. There was a lot of people like Buck Owens, and there was people that Bakersfield was some sort of a I don't know. It was like country music artists found their way to Bakersfield and had their success out of there. I don't understand why, actually. It may be because of the migration that took place in the 30s or whatever. There was a lot of people that came out there from Oklahoma and Arkansas and Texas that had a lot of soul. And this thing we call country music kind of came out of those honky-tonks, and some of the same area that a lot of other things came out of.
Was it hard for you to adjust to success and stardom, having come from poverty and, having lived in prison off and on for so many years? I think it's hard for a lot of people to adjust to that.
There's a there's a thing that happens, like when you leave the penitentiary, when you've been there for 3 years, you have friends and you have a way of life and you have a routine and a a whole way of life that you just give up all of a sudden. One day you're there and you're next day you're not there, and you don't have any more friends from the outside because things went on when you left, and you can't find anybody there, and the people you left behind in prison are really your only friends. And there's a period of adjustment that took me about 120 days, I don't know, about 4 months. A couple of times I really wanted to go back, and it's really a weird sensation. It's the loneliest feeling in the world about the second night out of the penitentiary.
Merle Haggard, recorded in 1995. Next week, he'll receive a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Grammys. 10 of his early albums will be re-released this month. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.